You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the Dreaming. Alrighty, so I'm joined in the studio today by Mel Chun, who's the audio producer and reporter for the Sunday paper. How you going, Mel?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you, Kieran?
Yeah, not too bad, I suppose. Same old, I guess. Yeah, I wanted to bring you in today just to have a bit of a yarn about the latest edition of the Sunday paper, noting that, you know, you have been a part of the Sunday paper team and you've done a lot of really great reporting work over in Kanaki. And you've also got an article in the latest edition, which is quite a great article, actually. A very exciting one.
Oh, cheers.
Yeah, no worries. So I guess to start off with, you know, can you just explain to the listeners what your role is in the Sunday paper team?
Yeah, totally. So I started with like issue 1 and 2. The original concept was actually just to turn them into audio versions. So we just got the writers from those articles in issue 1 and 2 to like read their articles out. And then I kind of just edited them, recorded them and edited them and put them up on the website. Mostly just because I was like, I find it easier to listen to stuff than to read it. So I was like, it'd be great if there was an audio version. And then because I was doing that, I was kind of like, oh, well, let's just do some interviews and stuff like in between the issues of the Sunday paper. So I started just doing interviews mostly with like Indigenous resistance struggles around the world or just like people kind of doing direct actions. So we did, we did one with the Palestinian Feminist Collective. We've done like the Tamil struggle. We talked to someone from Nunakpur. We've done struggles here, like the Lee Point campaign and the Sister Kate's campaign as well. So,
Nice. Yeah,
all of that kind of thing. And it was just like a way to kind of keep Sunday paper stuff going in between. But then also, like, I guess what that evolved into, and actually the Unwelcome the King story that I did was the first actual like on the ground report. So that was the first time when I was like, oh, I could just do this as well. Like, I don't have to just do interviews. Like, I could actually be going places and like reporting for the Sunday paper on stuff that's actually happening. And that was like, that felt really important. And then I also met Chief Sunawami there and talked to him, which was when I started thinking about going to Kanaki. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but that was kind of the evolution of like audio and my relationship with the Sunday paper.
And it's really good too to be able to provide that that accessible format of the the podcast version of it for those who don't have the time to read or might struggle with it or whatever else, and they can still get involved and hear what's going on. So yeah, it's really, really great in my opinion that they've got the Sunday paper podcast there. But yeah, you mentioned Kanaki. You've just recently returned from Kanaki after spending some time over there with the Kanak people. What did being on the ground there reveal to you about colonization that isn't necessarily visible from Australia or through the mainstream media here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing is that there's so little that's actually visible from Australia, right? Like Free Kanaki Solidarity NAM have done incredible work to raise awareness, but as far as I know, they're pretty much like the only group that's really doing a lot. And the issue is that this stuff it's hardly reported on in French media, and it's reported on, incorrectly and unfairly in French media, let alone what actually gets filtered down to English speaking media. So, a lot of people here don't know anything about it, and there's like a good reason for that. It's because it's just like, it's not really reported on, which is kind of why this felt like a really important story to me as well. Because, we're talking about like what kind of stories I could report on for the Sunday paper. And there's like, stories of resistance in like Turtle Island or whatever that's like really important. But, that kind of thing is all over our social medias and all over the media and like well reported on already. Which is not to say it's not valid, but it's not like, I guess, as needed for someone to go there and be on the ground. So I think for that reason, that's why I felt like that story is important. But like back to the question, I guess, of like what it revealed to me about the colonization there. It's just like totally suffocating and invasive. Like as soon as I took the shuttle from the airport, we were just driving past checkpoints, armored vehicles, like gendarme or the like, you know, police and military just like stalking up and down with rifles, like everywhere. And so the suffocating nature of the military occupation there was like very in my face straight away. So that was a revelation. But then also how there's just all of these tourists that are just going there on holiday and like, yeah, like even in the shuttle from the airport, they were just sort of like, oh, look at all the like armored trucks and stuff. But no one was going, oh, why is there a military occupation in this place that we're holidaying?
Yeah.
But then the shuttle just took them straight to these like, you know, luxury resorts that are right on the coast in the south. And so for the rest of the trip, they wouldn't have seen any of that. They're just in a little like cordoned off area with
a little safe bars bubble for the tourists.
Exactly. So I think that as well was really stark to me. And I think the other thing was like how like present and scary the settler violence is, like the settler militias and stuff, which we can talk a little bit more about later. But yeah, I think that those were the kind of things that struck me straight away. And then just like how total the discrimination and apartheid is there as well, like in every facet of the Kanak people's lives. It's really stark.
Yeah, and you know, it is something that most people in Australia are completely oblivious and unaware to. And you know, this is one of our closest neighbours as well.
I think
there's what, like maybe one or two other places that are a bit closer, you know, Papua New Guinea and West Papua, and I think Kanak is like the third closest or something like that.
Yeah, it's like a 2-hour flight.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's mad.
Yeah, 2-hour flight. It's like a 2-hour flight from here to Brisbane.
Yeah, you know, exactly, yeah.
Put it into perspective, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really great that you have been over there and you've been able to, you know, do that very important work to get that information out of there. Speaking of, you know, the article that you've helped author in the Sunday paper, first I just want to say I reckon the name of the article's just fire. Like what an amazing article headline. For the listeners, it's The Colonization of Souls. That's the name of the article. But, you know, in that article, you write a bit about how colonial power works, not just through laws and borders, but how it works through stuff like culture, psychology, and even, you know, your everyday life. How did your time in Kanaki help deepen your understanding of that process?
Firstly, I'll just say that I can't take credit for that title. That was actually... that was a line that Oriane said to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I think you're going to play Oriane's interview after this.
Yep.
So, yeah, listeners will be able to pick up on that. But because of, like, what other Kanak people and, you know, members of Free Kanaki also had kind of said to me before that, immediately when she said that in that interview, I was like, that's the headline.
Yeah.
Because it so encapsulates this this feeling that a lot of people seem to have after the May uprising of just this like hopelessness that was engendered by this kind of like colonial, you know, education and this colonial kind of like, yeah, like occupation of the soul that made people feel like, you know, they've almost got the majority, the Kanak people in Kanaki. So there's the ability there to successfully uprise, but like because of that colonization of the soul, I guess, like that it's just this poison. Oriane talks a lot about like the colonial education and how it's really sort of like poisoned the minds of young people over there. And so like a lot of the work of the feminist movement over there and her organization, the Movement of Independence, is to kind of like reverse that education. But she was talking to me about how hard that is. And, you know, like young people are committing suicide and the older people, their parents' generation are really, you know, just destroyed by the fact that the young people are like on the barracks and like risking their lives and dying for liberation and like nothing's happening. So it's just this like, you know, all-encompassing thing. And then, like, I just this one thing that she said to me as well, like, just completely floored me. She talked about how the colonization, the colonial education had come to even define what they thought of as happiness, and that even like their idea of happiness had been colonized. And for me, that was just like one of those moments where I was just like, fuck, this is like so intense and such a task to reverse that. But, you know, they're up for it and there's the will for that. But it's really, I think that's what I think of when I think about like the colonization of like culture and psychology. Is that interview particularly, but really like the experiences of everyone over there that we're just dealing with all of that propaganda and
And it's something we tried to address a bit in this edition of the Sunday paper, the way that, you know, capitalism and colonialism and liberalism itself, you know, the way it very much manifests, not just in our politics, but like our everyday life. You know, like as you're saying, even like how we define happiness and, you know, how we define our feelings and thoughts, and you know, it's all been poisoned by liberalism and colonialism. Yeah, it's such an important thing to try and address, in my opinion. We're going to play that interview after this one, get a little sneak peek of the episode from the Sunday paper. Speaking of which, you know, you do have a podcast episode for the Sunday paper that does document part of this journey. I suppose, you know, from your point of view, what sort of responsibilities do you feel as a journalist and as a storyteller when you're actually sharing the struggles that aren't necessarily your own?
Yeah, I think this brought up a lot of like ethical questions for me as a journalist, and it really reminded me of my time in community radio, because I kind of started out working in community radio and then I was doing... like I was reporting for mainstream organizations for a while, Agence France-Presse and The Guardian and that kind of thing, which is, a whole other story. But, you know, I guess like a couple of lessons that community radio taught me that mainstream media never taught me is, one, this idea of like, is this my story to tell? And if it's not my story to tell, like how do I facilitate the telling of it or tell it in a way that is responsible and puts forward the voices of those whose story it is to tell. So that was kind of a question that I asked myself, and kind of also like why I have focused largely on just like interviews up until this point. But I really kind of had to think about how to put this together in a way that was responsible in that way, because obviously it's not my story to tell. I'm not a Kanak person. And I even kind of questioned the first person perspective of the article. But then I kind of realized that there was no other way that I could really put the audience in that moment. And so I did kind of like approach it from a first person perspective, but that was more to just be like, here I am, this is what I'm witnessing kind of thing. But in terms of responsibility, I think it's like always coming back to that focus of like, it's not my story to tell. So like, who can I talk to that can tell this story? Who can I, kind of ask about these questions that will understand them? But then the other thing, and also like, this is something that I learned, I think when I was working for FBI radio, I think it was either Sharika or Tanya Ali, the director, that said this to me, but they had this thing of connection over content. So there's always like this focus on having a deeper connection with the community, and that should never supersede like a grab for content or an urgency for content. And so I think like when you ask like what was my responsibility as a journalist, I think like a lot of that was actually the groundwork that I did before I went. So like meeting Chief Sunawami at the Unwelcome the King protest. And then even before that, I think I had done like a fundraiser with Free Kanaki or something. So I knew those guys. And, you know, so I was kind of building trust there. And then there was a couple of times where we had like video calls with the contacts in Kanaki before I went over there. So I, you know, I was trusted in the community and I kind of like communicated my intentions. I communicated like what the Sunday paper was about. But then even when I was over there, like something that I really liked about the Kanak custom was that like whenever you go to a new place and meet people, they have this thing where like the guests will offer like a piece of cloth and usually a bit of money, like 10,000 francs or something, which I think is like $10. And it's this custom where you'll like offer that and then you'll stand around the gift and you kind of like state your intentions. You state the intentions of your visit and then the host will like accept the gift and accept your intentions kind of thing. That's that's my interpretation of that. I hope that I'm saying it right. But yeah, I think like as a journalist, that was a really unique and awesome opportunity for me that I've never had before to be like, this is my intention in doing this interview. Because normally, like, you know, you're just like, oh, I'm here from 3CR. Can you tell me about this or whatever? That's the best case scenario. Like, I'm going off on a bit of a tangent now, but like these, you know, mainstream media organizations that rock up to the rallies or whatever, and they don't even tell you what news organization they're from.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't even have it like on their shirt or whatever. And they'll just put a microphone in your face and be like, what do you think of this? Or they'll just take photos of you like without asking or whatever. Like, that's so unethical.
Yeah.
Even as a mainstream journalist, that's an unethical thing to do, to just be like, I'm not going to state my intentions. I'm not going to state who I'm going to tell about your story or anything. I'm just going to like shove a microphone in your face. And so that, you know, that was kind of consistent with my experience in mainstream media, but like not so much in community radio, kind of going back to that. But anyway, yeah. So I guess like I was introduced by like the people that I was with as a journalist and an activist, and it was explained what the Sunday paper was about. And that connection was kind of made. And it meant that I was really able to have these meaningful conversations with the people I was talking to because there was that trust already there.
Yeah, yeah. So important.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And it's just like better as well. Like it's better. It's a better interview when you know, you're already not part of the community, but like there's history there.
Yeah, yeah. And you're building that rapport with it and earning that trust and getting them to really open up as well about, you know, what they're thinking and feeling and stuff like that. But in a way where they can have some autonomy too and still, you know, withhold whatever they might want to withhold if they don't want certain people to know about it or whatever. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really important too. Like I often said, well, I always said before an interview, like, you know, if there's anything you don't want to talk about, just like tell me beforehand. If there's anything that comes up during the interview, like, let me know if you're not comfortable talking about it, and always checking about anonymity, checking about the use of names and all of that kind of thing as well.
Yeah.
That's sort of like the nitty gritty of like responsible journalism. But the overarching thing is just like care for community, right?
Yeah.
So
No, I really like the way you put that at the start about the whole, you know, community over connection over content.
Yeah, it's a good mantra.
It is. Yeah. Definitely. Speaking of connection and stuff, one of the other things I wanted to ask you is, before we do, though, actually, I'll just quickly remind everyone, you're listening to Yilliman on 3CR, 855M, your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online via the playback service. And I'm currently interviewing Mel Chun from the Sunday Paper team, having a bit of a yarn about the latest edition of the Sunday Paper that's coming out, The Pitfalls of Liberalism, and talking a bit about Mel's article and Mel's broader role in the Sunday Paper as well. So back to, you know, talking about like connection and community and stuff like that, you know, we do get people over here in so-called Australia who, you know, quite often talk about solidarity with places like Kanaki and, you know, other places as well, like Palestine or Sudan, Congo, you know, all of these other places that are facing imperial occupation and colonialism. But quite often, you know, when people talk about solidarity, it's often in a very abstract or symbolic kind of way. Based on what you've witnessed, you know, what does actual meaningful material solidarity look like, in your opinion?
So actually, at the end of every interview that I did over there, I asked like some version of, you know, what do you want people in so-called Australia to know about Kanaki and what can they do to help? Something like that. And a lot of people actually just said, just learn about our struggle again, because there's just not that much education about it. I think the Kanak independence movement has just really struggled to like get people on board because no one knows what's happening, you know, like it's a small island, and yeah, it's the only media is French again, and it's like very compromised. So yeah, just learning about what's going on over there is really important. Obviously money is really important, which is like a hard thing to say because, you know, a lot of us don't have a lot of that, but they really are kind of just like struggling with every facet of life at the moment, because the discrimination is just like in everything, you know, education, healthcare, housing. It's really
even access to stuff like food and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember. You know, when we first started organizing around Kanaki stuff, like that was one of the main issues that they were facing over there. Is that still a similar sort of case where there's not much food in the shops and stuff? And
it's hard for me to say, because we were mostly based in the south. That's where a lot of the settlers are. So like all of the French supermarkets are pretty well stocked. And then we did some trips up to the north, but then we only we like hung out with, you know, like Sea Cat or whatever up there, and like ate the food that they'd prepared. So I didn't really get to look at like what the, you know, markets and stuff are like up there. But from, you know, personal recounts, yeah, I think that they're struggling with everything, including food, for sure, still. I don't know, if it's necessarily as bad as like in the aftermath of the May uprising, but I think it's still a real struggle for a lot of people. So money, so Free Kanaki, I have an ongoing fundraiser that's just like for that general stuff to assist the Kanak people. But there's also a specific fundraiser for a delegation that's coming in May. So I have a little bit of information about that at this stage, but the delegation, coming in May. So we're trying to fundraise $8,000 by April to pay for their like flights and accommodation and that kind of thing. So yeah, if anyone wants to like run a fundraiser or just like make a donation, you can go to Free Kanaki Solidarity Nam on Instagram, and there's like a link and a QR code there, but maybe we can put a link in the show notes or something for people that
check in the show notes,
don't have
as well.
Socials or whatever. Yeah, so that's really important. Another thing I was thinking about is like when I was talking to Clement, who is the artist who has the photo in the Sunday paper with his axe that he carved from the wood from the barricades in the 80s. He's such a cool guy. But, you know, one thing that he kept talking about, like apart from, you know, like the effects of like direct violent occupation and like incarceration and that kind of thing, like one of his real sort of like bugbears or irritants was that this theft of Kanak art practice. So he just kept talking, like he was looking at me, he was like, do you know they're using lasers to like make Kanak art, or like to make fake Kanak art, like they're using lasers to make our art? And he was so upset about it. And so there's these like factories in Noumea where they're like using lasers to cut out, to carve, you know, Kanak designs in wood and stuff and make basically fake Kanak art, which, you know, like happens everywhere and is really not good. But he was particularly hurt by it because he's an artist and he's trying to make a name for himself as, you know, he has a name, but he's trying to be recognized for, you know, his art practice that you know, the hours of care and like cultural knowledge that go into what he does, right? So he was kind of like, oh, you know, like, yeah, if anyone can run an exhibition or do an art market or whatever, like, I really just want to have an opportunity to get my art out there. So I guess I'm bringing that up because I think like solidarity means different things to different people, but like maybe part of that is actually just asking what solidarity means to individual people that are like involved in the struggle as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And Clermont is very involved in the struggle, but like for him, that's just something that is really important because it was particularly hurtful to him that this was, this kind of theft was happening.
Yeah. Well, it's a theft of, you know, cultural identity and heritage at the end of the
day.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it's not a little thing.
Yeah.
These violations of like indigenous, intellectual property and stuff like that. It's, an issue that we see a lot here in my own community as well. A lot of our artwork is mass produced over in places like, Southeast Asia and then exported back here to be sold to tourists when they jump off the planes. And it's an attack on identity at the end of the day as well, that attack on culture and stuff. But yeah, you do raise a good point, like, solidarity looks different to different people, and it's really just about, having those connections and, those conversations and seeing how can you actually support someone. But back to that fundraiser, I'll make sure I link that in to the show notes. So you can head to freecr.org.au/Yilliman and it'll be in the notes under today's episode, a link for that fundraiser. I've got a couple more quick questions. We're about halfway through the show, though. You're listening to Yilliman on FreeCR. So something else I wanted to ask is, after actually being over there and hearing all these Kanak perspectives on resistance and on stuff like sovereignty and survival, has it changed how you think about decolonization over here in so-called Australia?
Yeah. I think, one of the big things that was kind of really hopeful and exciting to me was just to hear perspectives on unity in the Pacific. And a lot of people when we interviewed them were thanks to the BPU and thanks to Aboriginal people for their solidarity. A lot of people came back to that. And that it seemed like that was really important to them, more important than, settler solidarity.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seemed like there was this vision for unity in the Pacific. And I guess, because they do almost have the majority there, and a lot of, Pacific nations do have the majority of Indigenous people, I guess from just hearing that, desire for solidarity and that their joy in feeling like they had solidarity on this continent, really made me hopeful for that idea of Pacific unity. I don't know. I feel I've been refraining from asking you questions because I know that I'm not the journalist in this situation. But what about you? Did it bring anything up for you about?
Not necessarily just the article, but just the last sort of it's been 2 years now, nearly. I think it'll be 2 years this May since the uprising. Over the last sort of just 2 years of having those, conversations and those connections with the mob over in Kanaki, it's, I'd say something similar. It's really good to be able to actually see and practice that unity of Indigenous peoples across the, Oceania region. Because, like you're saying, we're not necessarily a majority here on this continent, First Nations people, but when you look at the broader Oceania region, Indigenous people are the majority. And if we can all be together in unity and we can all, struggle and fight together, there's so much more we could achieve, and there's so many ways we can do it as well, propping up each other's resistance and even, little things like organising these fundraisers so that we can give some cash to the mob over in Kanaki so that they can actually, manage to feed themselves and clothe themselves and, whatever else they need the money for, to, prop up that struggle for them. And, not just struggle, but, help prop up their survival at the end of the day as well. Mm. It's something that's, so important in my opinion. And that's part of the reason why, when we first heard of everything that was kicking off over in Kanaki, part of the reason why, the BPU was one of the first organisations on this continent to want to get involved and want to get in touch and see what we can do to support them and help them and stuff. And, you know, just not to go off on a tangent and stuff as well, but it's also feels like something that's really, I suppose, like culturally and historically relevant and significant as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for listeners that might not know, there was a thing called blackbirding that happened during the 1800s. And what happened was when the United States abolished slavery at the end of their Civil War, a lot of those wealthy slave plantation owners sold their plantations and they actually came out to Australia to places like Queensland and New South Wales. And on the way, they stopped in at places like Kanaki and other islands in the region. And they essentially kidnapped a whole bunch of Indigenous people, brought them over here to work as slaves in plantations here. But when they brought them over, they chucked them on the same missions as, you know, First Nations people. Like, we all just lumped in together on these same, you know, concentration camp style missions. And we all, you know, forced to work side by side on the plantations and stuff. So post-colonization, there's a lot of shared history between mob and Kanak people, especially up in Queensland as well. But not only that, you know, even before colonization, like, we would have had trade routes, you know, going to places like that. We would have been in contact with each other. And it's actually really interesting, just another little side tangent, that picture you referenced earlier where Clement has his, what did you call it, an axe?
They were calling it, the translators were translating it as an axe, but I'm not sure what the French word or the Kanak word would have been.
Well, that exact style of, I'll call it an implement, that exact style of implement, we actually used here on the southeast coast as well.
So,
you know, I wonder if that was something that, you know, was maybe traded as an idea from one to the other, you know, hundreds or even thousands of years ago. And there's also so much genetic crossover with our people as well. Like, you know, Blackfellas are Melanesian. Blackfellas are Melanesians. You know, we're quite genetically close as well. And even when you look at our culture and stuff, you know, a lot of our cultural stories and, you know, the way we practice culture is quite similar to each other.
Mm.
So, you know, for me, we're one big people across the Oceania, Indigenous people, and yeah, we really need that solidarity and to stand together and support each other.
Yeah.
So absolutely. We can actually, you know, liberate ourselves and each other. Yeah.
Totally.
But yeah, it's also been really good just to, like, you know, look at the way that they do stuff and to, you know, look at the way that they've been resisting and, you know, learn from them whatever we can, because, you know, inevitably and eventually there'll be a time here when we're struggling for our liberation. And, you know, if we can take lessons from, you know, places like Kanaki and look at what did and didn't work, you know, we can apply that or not apply that in our situations and, you know, hopefully try and have a bit more of a successful endeavor here by learning from those, you know, past lessons and vice versa as well. You know, we've done a lot of panels with mob from Kanaki and we always learn a lot from each other when we have these shared sort of like online panels and webinars and stuff. Mm. And it's always just so ironic as well, I think. Maybe ironic's not the right word, but it's so, you know, ironic to listen to each other's stories and how similar they actually are. Like, I remember when a couple of weeks ago now, or maybe a couple of months ago now, we had a webinar and we had some of the aunts from Kanaki and they were talking about issues like, you know, mass incarceration and deaths in custody and child removal and, you know, the attack on culture and all of these other things. And it's like, yeah, we've got the same stories here. Mm. You know, it's the same sort of yarns and, you know, vice versa too. When we'll talk about our issues, when we'll talk about our issues here, you know, the aunties will be like, oh, yeah, it's the same over here.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's...
Yeah, well, I guess people might also not know that Kanaki was a settler colony and a penal colony as well. Which I guess might be why they're so similar too, right?
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to ask one or two more questions, I suppose. After producing, you know, both the article and the episode for the Sunday Paper podcast, what conversations going forward do you hope this work actually sparks among readers and listeners, especially those who are still shaped by liberal frameworks?
It's a big question.
It's a big question.
I guess, like, the old school journalist in me wants to say, like, oh, you know, I just tell the story. I'm not going to tell people what to think or whatever. But I suppose, like, one of the inevitable conversations that comes out of it, because there has been an armed uprising there so recently, is the necessity of armed resistance, you know, because they were creating roadblocks and protecting the communities because that was necessary, because there was French police and military and settler militias like actively, you know, attacking their communities. But then also like just looking at the May uprising in the context of the Noumea Accords and the proposed unfreezing of the electorate and the referendums that they had, referenda or whatever, which, you know, is all like history that I guess people might not know about, but that's all kind of documented in the podcast series if people want to like look into that. But I suppose like the thing about the Noumea Accords was that that was like, a lot of people might see that as like a pretty liberal, it was a peace agreement, right? That came about after several uprisings in the 80s. And so then the Noumea Accords put in place that there was going to be like 3 referenda to decide on independence. The first 2 failed because, you know, all the French settlers there are pro-France. Well, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them are pro-France.
Yeah, yeah.
And the independence movement, like, actually did a lot of work to try and, like, raise awareness. And, of course, there's, like, voter discrimination as well, right? So all of the North is pretty much, like, populated by Kanak people, and that's, like, the disadvantaged, you know, part of Kanaky. It's really hard to get people involved in voting, like, all of those same problems.
Yeah.
So the third referendum, they did a lot of work to like get, you know, connect people involved in voting and like trying to get this referendum passed on independence. And then it ended up falling in, during COVID. And of course the Kanak population was like disproportionately really badly affected by COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And so the independence party was like, oh, okay, like how about we delay this referendum because it's kind of not really fair. And the French refused, and so they boycotted the referendum. So then the third referendum failed as well. And so then that paved the way for France to go like, okay, well, we actually want to keep this colony. So we're going to put all of these like sneaky little laws in place, and we're going to try and unfreeze the electorate, which means that like more French people can like, you know, come and settle and blow out the, you know, the vote and the majority in the parliament or whatever.
Yeah.
So I guess, again, I'm not going to tell anyone what to think, but one might conclude from that sequence of events and from the conditions in Kanaky now that electoral politics don't really work in a colony. I suppose that's, you know, that's kind of the conversation that is coming out of it is like, what next then?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like if the French are going to constantly put these barriers, they want to keep it, like there's no question, you know, they have nickel mines there. Mm. And it's for them a really important strategic military base in the Pacific, which is becoming increasingly important for
Western, you know, hegemony.
Exactly.
Yeah. And just real quickly for the listeners, when we talk about nickel mine, I think Kanaky's actually got like the largest or the second largest nickel deposits in the entire world.
Something like
that.
So
it's quite a significant nickel mine setup. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've been mining it since like the 70s, I think, or even earlier. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know. Did that answer the
question? Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. Cheers. And yeah, you know, it is. Really, like, so much of it just comes back to like resource extraction and to military strongholds. You know, that's why they're refusing to give Kanaky up, because, you know, as you said, it's a military base for France in the South Pacific region, and they can pull so much resources out of it in terms of stuff like nickel and you know, the other stuff that they no doubt mine or extract on those islands, probably, you know, native timbers and whatever else. And it's also a holiday destination for Europeans in the South Pacific that they probably don't want to give up. But, yeah, I suppose, you know, yeah, we'll leave it at that. We've got this interview as well. But before you go, is there anything else you wanted to quickly, like, mention or shout out or touch on? I suppose, you know, obviously go and buy the latest edition of the Sunday paper. You can Google the Sunday paper, not the Saturday paper. That does pop up in the results. Don't click on the Saturday paper. Make sure it's the Sunday paper, or you can just head to the website slingshotbooks.com.au. But yeah, is there anything else you wanted to add before I let you go?
I guess just like big shout out to Free Kanaki Solidarity Naam. Like, they've done so much work on this for many years. And I've kind of only just come into it, you know, since last September or whatever. But the trip wouldn't have been possible without them, and it wouldn't have been possible without the support of the BPU as well. And just like, you know, your support as commissioning editor of this issue of the Sunday paper. Yeah, that's all. Yeah, go support them, go to their events and that kind of shit as well.
Yeah,
stuff
yeah.
as well.
Yeah,
I managed to not swear for the whole interview.
That's all right. That's all right.
All right.
But yeah, big shout out to Free Kanaki Solidarity Naam. They've been doing amazing work for the last 2 years. And in fact, you know, all of the work that we've done in the BPU with the mob over in Kanaki wouldn't have been possible without them providing stuff like translation services, because, you know, they speak French over there. They don't speak English. Well, there's a couple that might, you know, speak some broken English, but, you know, for the most part, it's two completely different languages here and there. So, yeah, big shout out to the translators in particular, but all of that whole crew as well. They're a solid crew.
That's a translation is a whole episode in itself, like how important it is for decolonial education, because when everything is like filtered through, you know, English media, and then like translation in itself is often compromised.
Yeah.
Like having translators that are like responsible and decolonial in their practice is so important, and Free Kanaki Solidarity Naam is so good at that. So
yeah.
But I'll leave it there.
Yeah, no worries. Well, thanks for coming on and stay tuned, everyone. I'm going to play this interview with Oriane next. You're listening to Yellowman 3CR, 855M, your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service.
Oriane Trulu is a feminist with decolonial politics. She is a member of the Pro-Independence Oceanian Movement, or MOI, and is also the World March of Women's National Coordinator for Kanaki.
Avec le mouvement des Océaniens indépendantistes,
so with the movement for of pro-independence Oceanians, I'm in charge of feminism of political decolonization.
L'objectif, c'est de conscientiser au maximum.
The aim is to raise consciousness, raise awareness
sur ce qu'est le féminisme,
on what is feminism, the type of feminism that we promote. And the main message, which is the struggle against patriarchy, notably in New Caledonia, it can't be disconnected from the question of decolonization. We work a lot on the coloniality of gender,
pour faire comprendre aux gens que, il faut absolument qu'on
to help people understand that we must absolutely eliminate it from our consciousness.
She references the work of prominent feminists Suzanne Onet in the 1970s and Dewek Goede in the early 2000s, and believes that young Kanak feminists today are carrying on that decolonial struggle. But there is still much more work to do.
We're at the point where there are a lot of things that we have integrated from French Western civilization into ourselves, and we haven't yet raised our consciousness and understanding of how that impacts us.
Oriane explains the complications of challenging aspects of culture and custom when so much of that has been corrupted by colonialism in the first place.
The Kanak soul is suffering from the colonial image of being violent, alcoholic, lazy, rapists.
She explains that without applying this decolonial lens, white feminists are unable to understand the issues of Kanak feminism.
And so when feminists come and question the foundations of the custom, it can be perceived as being in opposition to the anti-colonial struggle. And if we want to eliminate problems of sexism, of heteronormative patriarchy, of systemic racism, or destruction of life. We have to dig up the root of the problem. And we have to destroy capitalism.
I asked if she could give a specific example of this problem of white feminism.
So a really clear example is that every time we ask the specific questions about the problems that affect Indigenous women, we are told that we can't only focus on Indigenous women, we have to always think about the other women.
Along with this colorblind ideology, Oriane explains how the idea of peace is weaponized to silence resistance.
Instrumentaliser la paix civile.
There is an instrumentalization of the idea of peace in society and the idea of living together in peace, which is one of the aims of the Noumea Accord, to never look specifically at the situation of Indigenous women.
White bourgeois feminism, she says, is not neutral in this context, but actively harmful to the decolonization of gender.
Là où c'est violent, c'est que c'est subtil.
It's violent because it's subtle, because every time it's turned back on us and imply that we're racist, which is false. We've understood now by studying decolonization that this is a colonial practice that is practiced all the time, everywhere in the global south against all the colonized peoples.
And solidarity between colonized peoples, she explains, has been vital to the strengthening of their struggle.
So I wanted to really thank the World March of Women in Australia and the Black People's Union and our partners, because one of the ways we can respond to that is internationalist feminism and the feminist solidarity.
I ask about some of the work that MOI is doing on the ground. In order to understand this, I'm going to need to fill in some context. In episode one, I made reference to a proposed French law that sparked the May uprising. This law is commonly referred to as the unfreezing of the electorate. This law allows French settlers who have lived in Kanaky for more than 10 years to vote in local elections, contravening the Noumea Accords, which restricted voting to those who had settled prior to 1998. Unfreezing the electorate is seen as a way to undermine a future vote for independence.
So the unfreezing of the electorate represents for the Kanak people a danger, a huge danger of political minorization. So that would prevent the independence demand to be successful. That's what we were denouncing.
She explains to me the history of strategic French settlement in Kanaky and how it has always been a tool of colonization.
In 1972,
there was an official letter that Mesmer, who was the minister for the colonies, the Outre-mer, said they should send French people here so that Kanak people would be a minority and so that the independence request could not be successful. Achieved. So we had more and more French people coming here with a specific mentality. Settlers keep coming, and settlers are against the independence. So as for independence, we said, no, we need the freezing of the electorate.
There have been several legal cases, she says, against the freezing of the electorate. But on Friday the 19th of September 2025, the Constitutional Council of France decided that the freezing conforms to the French Constitution.
Donc en fait, tout ce qui s'est passé depuis mai.
Everything that happened since May, and until now, the pro-independence people were right. That's what the judges are saying, because they're saying it's conform.
Oriane says that they have always had to address accusations of racism and discrimination for supposedly taking away the voting rights of residents.
And
we always say to the pro-independence, if you want independence, you're racist. Which is absolutely wrong and false.
The independence movement, she says, has always envisioned a pluro-ethnic nation, but one that is also decolonized. This was a vision shared by Pierre de Clercq, the first president of the Union Caledonian.
Et Pierre de Clercq était
français. Pierre de Clercq was French.
Il a pris fait et cause pour contre le colonialisme.
But he was an activist against colonialism and for independence of Kanaky. Mm-hmm. And he was murdered.
We will be meeting with the Committee for Prisoners tomorrow. But Oriane introduces us to the issue and why it is at the forefront of the independence movement at the moment.
C'est que c'est les prisonniers militants camarades ne sont pas
reconnus. Our comrades who are prisoners are not recognized as political prisoners. They were treated as prisoners of common rights. And we want people to understand that they are political prisoners.
Seven independence leaders were arrested and deported to France. Other Kanaks who were already in prison were deported during the May uprising to free up space in the prisons. There are about 50 people all up who have been deported. Many have since been released, but they are expected to fund their own passage home, and so many remain stuck in France.
They were put into the aeroplane, and it was inhuman conditions. They were in handcuffs for the whole trip, keeping in mind that it's more than a 24-hour trip. They weren't allowed given time to prepare their things. To go to the toilet, they were in handcuffs, and there's someone who goes with you to watch you. The whole way along, and that was it was like that. It was their mothers who had been separated by their children.
Some
prisoners we know that it's very hard for them in France because they have no help. Their families from here have to help them.
This is one of the campaigns that the women's movement is working on, says Oriane.
Alors nous, les mouvements des femmes, on dit
so women's movements, we say it's unfair because it's the state that's who sent them, who deported them there. The French state should be the one bringing them back here. The families cannot find the money. Most don't have a job, etc. So now they're in France and they just have to survive.
Among those deported to France was the president of the FLNKS, Christian Tien, who doesn't have the right to leave France. I asked Oriane if she believes that the French state is using incarceration as a tool of colonization.
Very clearly, we, the feminist movement, we denounce the maneuvers which remind us of the time of the colonies. Like, you don't just deport people just like that without warning them, without the families are warned.
Et nous, on demande qu'à croire à cette France des droits de l'homme.
And we no longer believe in this idea of France as the land of human rights. They've given us no indication of that. So, of course, the decolonization of New Caledonia that we want towards full sovereignty for Kanaky, we want that to happen in conditions of peace and to negotiate. But for the moment, everything that's been doing against the Kanak people and especially against the pro-independence people means that we're not seeing that.
I ask Oriane about armed resistance as a countermeasure to the violence of the state.
So from the moment when we realize that there is institutional violence where the state uses its tools, thanks to public money, to quiet a social movement. This violence makes the violence of the people be born, and I think it's a legitimate self-defense.
Oriane also says that studying post-colonial literature on violence has helped them create a framework for their own resistance. She quotes Elder Camara saying it's hypocritical to only use the word violence to describe the violence of the people without saying that the institutions are violent or that the forces of order are violent.
We go further than that and we say that there isn't popular violence. It's legitimate self-defense when the state promotes colonial policies.
C'est l'argument qui retourne
because it's the argument which is always turned back against us. And it's been 172 years since colonization began, and we're always presenting the Kanaks as savage cannibals, violence. And so we'd really like to put the focus on the cause, how we're treated, because we've had enough. The colonized people, we're talking about the Kanaks, but it's the same method everywhere. It's the same methods. First, they decredibilize their claims. Then they demonize the people and their claims. And then they criminalize the leaders. Every time it follows the same pattern. So we say, no, we've had enough.
I ask Ariane, apart from what she has described, what other kinds of colonial violence is France imposing on the Kanaks today?
One of the most powerful weapons that the French state has found to reinforce Western domination is the colonization of souls. And we, mothers, women, big sisters, we're constantly up against this form of colonization. And it's very, very difficult to re-educate our children differently to the way in which the West has come to penetrate our imagination and the way that we see ourselves. We no longer have confidence in ourselves. Every time we define ourselves against white people, even the definition of happiness that we have is completely lining up with white people's. And it's extremely violent. It's their most powerful weapon. So today, to deconstruct that, we create feminist schools of decolonial politics where we go into the streets and we talk with people, and that's our school. We do popular feminist schools. It's very effective to fight against white ignorance in a racist system with white supremacy as its basis, but also a heteronormative patriarchal system. Recently, we had two cases of suicide. It was young men. All of this conflict, all of this ambiance, it's a consequence of the insurrection. So the families, people who lost their jobs, they no longer have money to pay their rent. So there are expulsions from people's housing. So all of the traumatic aspects of that have not been studied. They're not being treated. So we're in the process of creating another generation of traumatized people when we ourselves did not care for our traumas. And so we bring all of that intergenerational trauma along with us. I think it's the most violent weapon that they have.
L'éducation coloniale.
The colonial education.
She tells me again how important resistance movements in other Pacific nations have been to understanding these systems of oppression and feeling empowered to rise up.
The Aboriginal nations, who I thank once again very much, because they're an enormous support. Even in terms of the way we think as activists, because we're impacted by the way in which we are thought about, and to be in connection with other nations that have experienced colonization is very important, and it helps us to reconnect with ourselves. It's our biggest weapon against colonization.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.